Thanks, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. Happy New Year. This is the NYSO, the first NYSO Open Teleconference for 2024. My name is Nettie Legaffi. I'm the NYSO Associate Executive Director. And today I'm joined by Suzanne Bedell and Bill Kasdorf and Rinka Hoekstra. They're the co-chairs and key participants on a content platform linked document working group. That's our topic today. It is also known as ANSI NYSO Z39.105. This is a brand new standard that NYSO published less than a month ago. And we'll be moving on to our discussion in just a few moments. I just want to cover a brief bit of boring housekeeping. So many of you, or most of you, have dialed in, and we're so happy to have you today. Our program is going to be a pretty informal discussion between me and Bill and Suzanne and Rinka, and you are welcome to ask questions at any time. We are also going to have dedicated time for questions and reactions at the end of the discussion. So if you're not speaking, please do mute your line, as that helps to cut down on extraneous noise like dogs barking or leafers or snow blowers, what have you. If you don't have a dedicated mute button on your phone, you can hit *6 to mute, and then the same *6 again to unmute. So that should be hopefully pretty easy. And we're going to post it on our website so that the conversation and questions are recorded. But there will be a time at the very end where we will turn off the recording in case you have any questions that you don't want to have recorded. There will be an opportunity for that. And I think that's it for my housekeeping. So on to our content-oriented discussion. So happy to have you with us today, Suzanne, Rinka, and Bill. Could you please introduce yourselves and say what is it about CPLD that got your interest, makes you want to participate? What is the key for you? And maybe start with Suzanne.
Get myself unmuted. Thanks, Nettie. Yes. And thanks, everyone, for joining. My name is Suzanne Bedell, and I'm retired from Elsevier for the last couple of years now. Prior to retirement, I was running the content reference and professional and reference educational content development. And at that point, we had really decided that we needed something more robust than XML to mark up our content, to allow it to go into platforms that we were serving. And so NYSO, we brought CPLD, which was developed in Elsevier, conceived by Elsevier teams, to NYSO for two reasons. One was to just get help in hardening the standard so these software engineers could use it. But the second reason was really that we all hoped that the community would adopt it. And because we really felt like the development of a standard that was used for interchanging not just content, but also data, could allow for collaboration and interoperability, not just within Elsevier, but within the other organizations and systems that were using the standard. And if it was successful, we could take a next step in accelerating, in our case, accelerating science and the research that supports it. So that's a little bit about why I'm interested in CPLD. And I'll just say, Nettie, you said it was content platforms, but the CP stands for content profiles. I'm sure
it does. I'm so sorry. I'm a little bit discombobulated this morning, so I apologize. You're right. Thank you for pointing that out.
Sure.
Yes. And Bill, can you say your name in a few words about your interest?
Sure. My name is Bill Kasdorf. I'm an independent publishing technology consultant. And most of my work centers on editorial production workflows, accessibility, systems, et cetera. And it's most of my career has been dominated by, not exclusively, but mostly scholarly and scientific publishing. So this is something that I was very interested in from the get-go. And as it happens, I was aware of this Elsevier developing the CPLD standard or the CPLD format, probably a year or two before they provided it to, presented it to NISO. In fact, I think that's why I was invited to be co-chair of the working group, because I already knew about it and I was very enthusiastic about it. And I'll just give you a couple of reasons briefly why I was so enthusiastic about it. First of all, you know, I'm pretty much known as an XML advocate. I'm still an XML advocate. So, you know, this doesn't replace XML. And one thing that I like to really stress with people, because the first thing they think when they hear about the CPLD format is, well, wait a minute, what about JATS? Well, JATS is not a rendering format. It's a way of characterizing your content that then gets rendered in a format like HTML or PDF, et cetera, et cetera. So nobody actually reads the XML in JATS. The XML serves a purpose in order to make it readable. And it's specifically journal articles. I'll get back why that's, why is it relevant in a second. Two things that are happening in the research and publication space that I think are very relevant is that researchers are increasingly interested in or need to communicate their research way upstream from when the actual formal article is ready to be published. And so one thing about CPLD is that it can describe any arbitrary chunk of content and associated resources, however big or however small. It's not tied to this somewhat print-focused journal article format that we've come to rely on. And it doesn't compete with it. The journal article is still completely important part of the ecosystem. But the other thing is that CPLD is more than just the text of the article and some links. It actually packages up a lot of the resources that are relevant to research, and it can be communicated when it's ongoing. So I'm getting too far down the path here, but as you can tell, I was very enthusiastic about this as the, you know, a very necessary format for research, and happy to be able to participate in making it a standard. Very pleased that they offered it to NISO, because I'm also a big standards advocate.
Great, thanks, Bill. Rinka, could you say your name and a little bit about your connection to CPLD?
Yeah. Thanks, Nadia. I'm Rinka Hoekstra. I'm Senior Director Architecture for Knowledge within Elsevier, so I'm still with Elsevier. And I got involved with the standard about 2017, so it's already a while back. I wasn't sort of technically involved, but I was sort of the idea of publishing scholarly content as HTML, the way we currently deliver it on most of our platforms, all publishers do, and marrying that with semantic technologies was very close to my heart because of before I joined Elsevier, I was an assistant professor at the University of Amsterdam, Free University of Amsterdam, working with linked data, semantic web technologies in the scholarly domain, and before that also in the legal domain. And also when sort of coming to work with publishing information, and the XML formats are very useful, as Bill has also said, but they can be quite rigid in the sense that if you have an XML-based process in place and you want to change any of the XML, then that will be quite involved. Whereas when you're in the current day and age where we have all these data science components that extract information from our content and want to expose that information to our customers in various different ways, including knowledge graphs or large, in the end, we're all interested in what the scholarly content says, not so much what's the letters themselves, the words themselves. So being able to marry this more presentation oriented way of looking at scholarly content with this more semantics and interpretation and understanding oriented way of representing scholarly content was very appealing. And also, it wasn't very easy to do so. It was an interesting technological challenge. So that was another reason why I got involved.
That's great. I think the project has really benefited from having all of you involved, along with the other working group members. pleased about that. And sort of moving into the content profiling document stuff itself, could you talk about what's the problem that CPLD is trying to solve and set the scene a little bit in the publishing ecosystem or how that ecosystem might be changing? Suzanne, do you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll kick it off because I alluded to this. I alluded to this earlier, and I should say this is I sound like ChatGPT here, but this was current as of my last knowledge update for Elsevier, June 2021. But I don't think just in terms of publishing in general, we were really struggling with the content being locked into our books and journals. And even though it was a competitive advantage for Elsevier, our content, we really couldn't, you know, kind of spring it out of that print-bound format to start driving some of the new data-driven applications that we were building and really represented the future for Elsevier. So we had a vision. We wanted to see if we could try to develop content that could both flow directly into our print pipeline, because a lot of the revenue is derived still, especially on the medical publishing side, from our textbooks, but then also into the data platforms, and see if we could do that with little transformation. The more kind of post-production work we had to do, the more difficult it was for the editorial teams and the authoring teams to track the changes that had been made and make sure that they were being updated across all the different streams. And so we were really trying to solve a problem that was very close to close to the daily activities of the business. And that's when we moved to trying to develop this new format. And you know, the big vision for the problem we were trying to solve as publishers, but I think that this by extension, it certainly speaks to the authors as well, is making the content ready for data platforms. Many of our authors, again, especially those in medical publishing, didn't just want their book, didn't just want their content to be available in a book. They wanted it to be available, you know, at point of care and in much more sophisticated applications. And in order to do that, we really had to make the content smarter. And then lastly, you know, as more and more we move into natural language processing and machine learning applications, we really wanted to figure out how can we strengthen the content, you know, and deliver just smarter information on as a base for that technology to sit and allow the editorial teams and the software engineers a better ease in repurposing the content and enabling interoperability of the content across our business. So that was the hope for the markup.
Allowing content to be more easily repurposed.
Yeah.
Bill or Rinka, any other comments on that, or we can move on to the next point?
Yeah, I do have a couple of comments because I was actually looking at this from a different perspective than Suzanne, who's looking at it from the publisher's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at it more from outside the publisher's perspective. And let me give you an example. You know, I've been around for a long time, and I was, before there was such a thing as XML, there was SGML. And a lot of the scientific literature was based on, frankly, the Elsevier DTD, but they were all proprietary, right? Springer had theirs, Chicago had theirs, et cetera. But they kind of trace their genealogy back to what was called the Majeure DTD at the time. Well, I was really interested in this standard not being an Elsevier spec. Let me just be flat out, say that flat out. And in no way is that being critical of Elsevier, and Rinka can take over after I'm done here. But it's really important for people to understand that we had a lot of leading scientific and scholarly publishers, IEEE, Taylor & Francis, et cetera, involved in the working group, so that there was plenty of input from publishers that were either peers or other than Elsevier, and also people elsewhere in the ecosystem, like some academic library participants and service providers like Crossref were involved in the standard. So the fact that this standard is not in fact owned by a publisher is really a big deal, because, you know, I'm a standards advocate, and it's really important that this is a NISO standard. It's not an Elsevier standard. And then one other comment that I think is really important in this, and why I was so attracted to this format in the first place, is that, you know, I'm sure people are thinking, oh my God, a whole new format. Well, not really, because everything in CPLD is based on common web standards like HTML and CSS and JSON-LD and schema.org, et cetera. It's all of the component parts in CPLD making it do what it does are technologies that we already know how to use commonly. So I'll kick that over to Rinka at this point for any further comments, but I think those are important.
Yeah, so that, I guess,
Whoop, you're muted, Nettie.
We're breaking apart, yeah.
Sorry, I think I got muted. Any other comments about the publishing ecosystem and how CPLD is trying to solve problems there?
Yeah, for me, I think it's a combination, I think, of what Bill and Suzanne said. So Suzanne said reusability, repurposing of content, and Bill is a big fan of open standards. I'm a fan of open standards myself as well. And I think what's key, and I think the battle that we're fighting in the publishing world all the time, both as publishers and as researchers, is this interlinking of content, being able to traverse the scientific content across multiple publishers, across multiple types of content, multiple media types. And that linking is essential if you want to do any kinds of reporting on your data, sort of how many articles have you published, how many citations does this article have, etc. And we didn't really have good technology across the entire publishing world for doing that. Right? Everybody was coming up with their own way of doing that internally. And there's a lot of wasted effort in making all of that work. And if we all commit to a standard where that linking and that identification of individual parts of documents, individual parts of, you know, whatever type of content you have, if that's sort of built in, that gives you so much power in terms of that interlinking, building, doing analysis and statistics, but also provenance tracking. So where did this idea come from in the end? How can I trace this back through all of the content through time? So I think that's really what this standard enables, really having a much more robust way of interlinking scientific content.
Oh, that's very interesting perspective too. So thanks. So then, if those are the problems, how could a standard help? And any comments on how CPLD will help these situations? And I don't know if we had anyone who wants to jump in on that.
Well,
I'll
kick it. Yeah, I can kick it off. But just from the viewpoint of the publisher, there's an opportunity to really be able to, as Rinka talked about earlier, better describe both the structure and the meaning by splitting those two things apart, and being able to focus on what this content really, really means through the tagging, but that then supports the extraction of entities, the linking of those entities. You can normalize that content in a way that you couldn't without this additional structure to it and the relationships across the content. And as I was saying earlier, you can reduce the ambiguity, especially in some of these more sophisticated domains, but with data schemas and schematic rules. And that really improves your data integrity. And that was, again, where we were, where, you know, the more you try to build links between these different data sets, the more critical that data integrity becomes.
Right.
And in medical and legal fields, we also saw how it could really help us with things like compliance. You know, making sure that the data was meeting the regulatory requirements. So those high level were some of the things that we wanted to get out, in addition to really helping with our pipeline workflows in a way that I talked about earlier.
Yep. Just wonder, we're going to move on now into the kind of meat of standard a little bit. Rinka, could you describe a basic overview of CPLD? So what is a content profile? And what is a link document?
What is a link document? What is a content profile?
Yes. Hello?
What? Was a question or no?
Needs to mute, I think, or did somebody have a question?
No, I'll just go ahead. We'll see. So essentially, where CPLD differs from other XML-based formats is that CPLD says, let's use the format that's most suitable for the purpose. So for presentation and for rendering, as Bill was saying earlier, we chose HTML because that's the richest format that we can currently use for creating very highly dynamic content. Everything we see on the web is all HTML based. HTML5 is really very powerful, and it's very well supported by lots of different vendors. Contrast that with XML formats, and everybody has their own XML format. So that solves a huge problem of interoperability alone. If we say we use HTML, because then we've essentially covered that part. But for the metadata, the tagging, annotations, enrichments of all the things that are being said in the article, or the things that we want to say about the article, like traditional metadata, who's the author, what's the title, when was this published, copyright information, all of that, that should not be in the HTML because that's not what HTML was meant for, right? And in XML formats, we tend to mix those together. So in CPLD, we take them apart. We have HTML for presentation, or this is just the content. This is what it should look like. This is for humans to consume if they want to read the article or any other type of content, because CPLD is not restricted to just journal articles. And we use JSON-LD or linked data. JSON-LD is just a syntax, a format for linked data to capture anything we want to additionally say about the article. And this allows us to have that separation of concerns, right? We don't have to deal with problems of metadata in the original presentation format because it's not there anymore. And also, if we want to say additional things about the content that we didn't really envision for in the first place, we can just freely add it to the linked data because linked data is very open in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So what then is a linked document? Well, a linked document is any HTML file that points to a JSON-LD file and says, and the JSON-LD file has to say, I'm a linked document. I conform to the NISO CPLD standard. And there are some additional constraints, namely that they both need to have a shared identifier. That's one we call the document identifier. And it needs to be an IRI, which is an internationalized resource identifier, a URL. And anything that appears in the HTML, any important HTML tag, needs to have an identifier as well, right? And then in the JSON-LD, we can start adding statements about those things in the HTML. So the JSON-LD can contain, say, this document has a part. That part is that HTML element, and that is actually a title. Or this thing over here, it's a paragraph, and it actually mentions a relation between this drug and this disease, for instance. So you can start building a whole set of statements about the document. So that's what a linked document is. A content profile is essentially what a schema is, a what we have in XML schema, we have a schema that dictates what a document should look like. That's what we have with CPLD as well. A content profile is a bit more freeform because of the flexibility of both the languages that we chose. But essentially, it states, these are the necessary ingredients for what we expect to be in a linked document if it was to be an article. So the standard has an example, scholarly article profile, that says, if you're a journal article, then we expect there to be a title, we expect there to be an author, we expect there to be an abstract, we expect there to be a bibliography section, etc. And if you want to make statements about citations, then this is what they should look like. So the standard is very open about for different content types. You will just stick to HTML and JSON-LD and some additional basic ground rules. But the profiles really specify, well, if you want to use this format to express what a journal article looks like, or what a book looks like, or even what a sort of some educational material looks like, right? Then that's specified in the profile. So that's how the two play together.
And then, so how is it then communicated? How is this CPLD encoded content communicated or used?
Yeah. So there are two files. So you can embed the JSON-LD inside the HTML. So you have like one coherent package. You can just ship the HTML file with everything. That's how, for instance, schema.org is often used on the web. But you could also you can link out to JSON-LD. If you want to package it, you could also use a manifest file that specifies exactly how the HTML and the JSON-LD play together, what the files are that are there, but also any additional files like images or videos or anything else that belongs to the article that needs to be together. And that how you want to distribute that is up to you. You could zip it or whatever, but there needs to be then a manifest file that tells you, this is the HTML file, this is the main link document, mm-hmm. and this is a JSON-LD that plays with it.
Okay. And then could you also speak to what extent is Elsevier using CPLD now?
Yes. Suzanne was already mentioned data platforms, and I think as any big data and information processing company, we're all moving towards more reuse of data across in a platform session, so multiple services mm-hmm. that use the same data for different purposes, and therefore also this interchange format is more and more important because we need to make sure that this all plays nicely together. We're using it currently in various data platforms. So as you know, Elsevier has three main market segments, health and corporate markets, which we call corporate markets, which is mostly life sciences, chemistry domain, pharma, and the traditional research scholarly publication domain. So that's the Science Direct and Scopus. And for each of these outlets, we're starting to bring in content profiles into the production pipeline. In health markets, we're looking at more native sort of content that we produce ourselves, clinical overview information, research for research publication. We're really using it quite intensively to do the interlinking and enrichments using data science components for publishing later on Science Direct. And in corporate markets for pharma and biology and life sciences, we're using the same base format to do the enrichment. So essentially, we're building knowledge graphs on top of our content for our products using this technology. So we're using it quite extensively already. Gradually growing. It's not yet the primary format internally, but it's soon becoming one. And it's a big company, so it takes a while for this to stick.
Yeah, no, it's so. So in that vein, moving to a practical piece of our discussion today. Now that the NISO CPLD ANSI Z39.105 is published, how can we help potential adopters, maybe even the people on this call, help them to look into it, dip their feet in, test it out? I know there were a few things we put into the appendices of the standard, the Appendix A that you mentioned earlier, the definition for scholarly articles. There's also a GitHub repository. Do any of you want to talk about what could someone who's on the call today do to start looking at it and trying it out?
I guess I'll make a couple of comments that are related to my earlier comments, and that is how important it is that this standard is based on already existing standards. So, you know, I mentioned common ones that everybody knows about and everybody uses, HTML and CSS and JSON-LD, et cetera. But you may think, well, wait a minute, there are other things going on here. There's this packaging going on, and there's, what about the annotations that Rinka mentioned? Those are also W3C web standards. So it's not that this invents a new way of packaging and creating a manifest. It's using one that is already a global web standard, the packaging manifest standard. And the annotation standard was established many, many years ago. I was on the working group in the when that was developed. And it's always bugged me that publishers have not taken up this annotation standard because, you know, annotating things is so useful. Well, you know, I was so pleased that the fundamentally in the CPLD standard, that's how annotations are done, completely standards based. So for somebody getting to your question, Nettie, of, you know, how do I get into this? First thing to do is kind of look through to it and say, well, how much of this stuff do I already know how to do? Because it may surprise you that it's easier to implement than you might think.
Mm-hmm. And the GitHub repository, what's that for?
I'll let Rinka deal with it. He's more of a GitHub guy than I am.
Yeah, so we have the GitHub repository is there because we wanted to make sure that this is not just a PDF, because that goes against the idea of the standard, right? Yeah. So this standard should be a living standard. You should actually have a CPLD version of the standard.
It is a little bit ironic that NISO publishes it's the only one. Go ahead.
No, that's so the so we actually internally, at first we used the GitHub repository mostly for internal purposes, right? So for creating examples of, so testing out ideas, how do we want to capture what a title is? Do we want to do it like this or like this? What does a citation look like? How do I link to an external article? And all of those questions that were raised during the working group, for each of these questions, and even though we're using these standards, essentially what we're bringing those external standards together to create a more, essentially patterns for using them. And so that's what we used it for initially. We also used that as we were going to start defining, to start answering the question around validation. So what does it mean for a CPLD or for a linked document to be valid or not? Discussions around, should we be very strict or should it be very open? We settled on being very permissive. So we're testing for completeness, not for, so all the ingredients should be there, as I was mentioning in the scholarly profile. So we actually build a test suite that tests for these things. It's not complete yet, but it's a good start. We've defined all the tests. So the test suite is part of the GitHub repository. You can run the tests against any CPLD file to see whether it is valid or not according to the standard. And the second thing that we, as Elsevier, have contributed to the community is a viewer, a CPLD viewer. It's an extension of the popular Microsoft VS Code editing environment. You can just install the plugin and you can use it to open a linked document and browse it and not just view it as HTML, but you can see all of the metadata and all the annotations on it as well. And from there, you can even link out to the broader web to follow linked data links. So that's what the repository is for. And we hope that we can actually use the repository for further development of the standard. So create and collect more examples. We already have four or five examples that highlight certain aspects of the standards. But if we could grow that corpus, maybe we could publish some open access content there from various publishers to see what that would look like as a CPLD, bringing more tooling. So that's really what we're trying to use the GitHub repository for. But that's, I think, what one, now the standard is there. We need to start building a community around this. And I think this meeting is a good start.
I would encourage everyone to take a look at that and send your comments in. So thanks. And then I have another question about, publishers or resource holders with existing content, how should the content be analyzed for a CPLD application, or who decides what is included in CPLD? Is that something that would be all of a publisher's output or some of a publisher's output, or it depends? How do you move from your content into CPLD in terms of analysis, I guess, or that's up to the publisher? Does that make sense?
Yeah, Nettie, I'll take it. I mean, I think the answer is, well, Rinka alluded to it, you know, it's a migration, and mm-hmm. we started with content that the product teams needed in a certain way, and there was an immediate need for that content with our customers. So it was driven very much by market demand and the shortcomings mm-hmm. of the current.
That's always a good reason.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like any tagging, you can over egg it, right? You can put in a lot more than anybody can derive benefit from. So it's always from the business side, it's always a balance. So from where I sit as, you know, a manager, you want to see there's a market need for mm-hmm. this enhancement, and let that drive the decision making.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
One of the things I want to point out that I thought, a point that Suzanne made earlier that I think is really should resonate with people is point of care. I mean, boy, that's really significant when you're talking about medical content and, you know, having the content in a big old textbook or even just in a journal article. It's like, no, there needs to be a way for that information to be conveyed to the medical people that are actually working on caring for people. And it's more possible to do that with CPLD. Am I right, Suzanne? Is that a good characterization?
Because yeah. I mean, that was really one of the use cases where we were struggling to deliver the way it needed to be.
Yeah, and in higher ed, the very strong trend in higher ed for textbooks is platforms, so that most of the major publishers, while they're still publishing their books as books, what the students spend most of their time on is not the book, it's the platform that contains the content and other stuff. So that's a major sea change in the ecosystem.
Yeah. I guess speaking of that kind of content, textbooks and medical content, does CPLD deal with versionings? What if something needs to be updated, or how does that work?
Yeah, versioning is a huge thing. And in this first release of the specification, we did not address versioning, but it's our intention to because it's so critical for some of these really high value, for most high value research content. And so I'll use this opportunity to put in a pitch for the working group, which is, you know, we continue to see the standard evolving, and we would love people who actually would like to use CPLD as part of their application development and content development to join us as part in that working group to do things like delivering these next iterations of the standard.
And actually, I'll pop in with a versioning comment of my own. The working group that created from the NISO perspective, the working group that created the standard is now going to transition to become a NISO standing committee. So we're changing our version of that as well. And the standing committee will consist of people who are interested in supporting the standard, so people from the working group, but then also hopefully some new voices, and that group can talk about what's needed to support it, how can we help people implement it, what's needed for the future pathway of this standard. So we'll be putting that standing committee together in the next month or so. as we just published the standard in December, now moving forward for that. Any questions from the audience? Anything you've wondered or you want to pop in? Totally optional, but we do want to provide an opportunity for any reactions or questions of any kind. And if you muted your line, then you need to press star 6 to unmute. All right, well, then I'll ask one more 2023-24 question. How does CPLD relate to natural language models like ChatGPT? And what's the relationship between CPLD and AI kinds of content analysis, large language models? Anything you want to say about that?
Well, I had this question, and so I went to ChatGPT to answer it because it's far beyond my technical ability to do so. And the answer that came back basically is that language models generate text-based responses in natural language, and these are just plain text or formatted text. And it really is a separate, it's a separate exercise almost. But if you wanted to incorporate the structured data or the semantic information into the responses generated by something like GPT-3, then you would need to manually incorporate it or create applications to do so that add that structure as a next step. But you could see a world where this could be, something you express as CPLD as training through machine learning to deliver in a more automated fashion, which is something we were also looking at trying to do at Elsevier in a more structured kind of batch process, if you will.
Yeah, so I think in general, because we're using these standards, and they are naturally understandable for generative AI models because they've been exposed to so much HTML and JSONLD already. So one way of looking at this, I was already mentioning about the identifiability of all the different detailed aspects, parts of the content. One big problem with generative AI is that they can hallucinate. And how do you ground the answer that the AI provides? Solutions such as research augmented generation, which is if you do a search, essentially you ask a question, the AI does a search and the response is then summarized with references to the sources. CPLD allows you to give a much more fine-grained control because we have much more precise identifiers, so the generative AI can actually point to the exact sentence that says something rather than just the document. Another aspect is because we've built in the schema.org based representation of a lot of information in CPLD as part of the JSONLD, you can also use it to bring more facts into the realm of generative AI, so that you can actually do question answering over the knowledge graph that is linked to the CPLD document. So this is not necessarily already supported by things like GPT-4, but there are several vendors, especially knowledge graph vendors, who are already building LLMs where you can interrogate, using natural language, you can interrogate the graph directly without having to understand the query language. And then the answer will also be coming back as natural language, but grounded in the facts of the graph. So I think this is a very powerful combination of this both text-based and graph-based technologies that is now really becoming much more accessible for a broader audience because we now have a natural language interface provided by the LLMs.
Yeah, I often mention an example that's outside scholarly publishing, but it's a big field, which is the business intelligence field. And, there's a there's a provider right now that's doing exactly what Rinka is describing, where you know, in their enterprise, and some of these enterprises are huge, but they've got multiple databases. Say it's a manufacturing company. They've got a database of parts. They've got a database of staff. They've got a scheduling system. They've got vendors and contracts, et cetera. And all these things tend to be in separate, distinct databases that can't talk to each other. Well, what this organization has done is it's using all that information from all of the different resources within that organization and putting it all into a knowledge graph that can now connect all these pieces. And then they've got ChatGPT on top of it, able to query the graph instead of having to ask questions of specific components that don't know anything about what's going on in the other component, because everything is ultimately related in this manufacturing process. And the thing that I think is most cool about this is that if you ask the system a question, it literally cannot make things up. It will basically give you the answer. I apologize, but that data is not in my system. It just literally explicitly says, I don't have the data to answer your question. And that's really powerful, because now you can trust the system, right? That's big.
Yep, that is. Another question came in on the Zoom chat about, is this a version of EPUB format for scholarly needs? And Rinka, you answered it on chat, but I know some people have dialed in. So
no, yeah, sorry. Didn't realize
okay.
that. Sorry about that. So EPUB is actually using similar technologies, but focusing more on focusing more on the presentation. So how can we package? How do we do pagination? How do we package the information together into one convenient format? CPLD is similar in that aspect, because we're also doing the packaging. We also are using HTML, but we're using linked data and JSON-LD as well, which means that CPLD is much more, it's a bit more flexible on the content side, because EPUB is fairly strict on how things should be structured. CPLD is, you can combine multiple documents if you want to in one manifest file. But the JSON-LD aspects opens up everything you'd like to say about what the content is about, right? So it's not just the words, it's not just the text, it's not just the structure, it's not just the chapters, but it's really building that knowledge graph of that represents the content or the information contained in the content in a way that you can query it, that you can interrogate it, that you can maybe link out to things outside and follow those links. So it's opening up the content to the web of data in that aspect.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, being an EPUB guy, first of all, that's a really good question, and it actually is a relevant analogy. But Rinka has hit the nail on the head there, because for scholarly content, that's why CPLD isn't the same as EPUB. And frankly, EPUB has not gotten traction in the scholarly world, because it doesn't do those things. It's, you know, it's dominated by trade books, and the ecosystem is very different, because you've got all these proprietary reading systems out there that, you know, they're not the only way to deliver EPUBs, but a huge majority of EPUBs go through Amazon or iBooks or Google Play, et cetera. And they all have their own way of handling things, and they've got their own DRM on it. And that's a big obstacle in the scholarly world, because this content needs to be freely exchanged between parties in the ecosystem. So it's a good analogy at a high level, but as Rinka points out, when you get to the details, it's very different.
That's great. So we just have a few minutes left. I just want to be sure that anyone who has any questions in the audience, that you have a chance to ask. So another call for questions. *6 if you want to unmute. Otherwise, we will stop the recording to see if anyone has questions they don't want to be recorded. Todd, could you be so kind as to